Pariyatti Audiobooks presents Chapter 10, Speak Your Peace, from the book Cultivating Inner Peace by Dr. Paul Fleischman, as read by the author.
Chapter 10, Speak Your Peace. If I could do one thing for my society today, it would be to create community in which everyone was encouraged to speak from the heart and to listen to the messages of others. I've spent most of my life listening to varieties of justified complaints that no one listens to or understands. Unfortunately, we live in a non-listening, mass-market, person-inattentive society. The emphasis on efficiency, productivity, pleasure, and hurry that pervades society leave little room for building personal relationships around resonant communication of feelings. We live in a society uniquely devoid of conversation about the backdrop of infinite reality through which every shaft of light that falls on us has passed. We see the tint of this passage everywhere, but we suffer from derealization when we try to speak about its presence in our lives. Yet this cultural repression is changeable every time we ourselves dare to refer in our talk to the reality always present around us. Autumn in New England is an example, a season in which leaves color a kaleidoscope of mountain ranges and regions. How can we pursue our business in silence when the world is turning in death and revelry? Not just the panorama, but each tree, every limb goes pointilliste. A creation usually hidden within summer's green is suddenly unveiled and dances in dishabille across the landscape. If you collect a batch of autumn leaves, as you're apt to do with your 4-year-old child, who babbles to you that each one is a jewel, you can see that one leaf alone mirrors the wild russet and umber pigments of the whole hillside. Across its segments, down its veins, the one leaf is as flagrant and glorious as the Shenandoah. Each parish of the spectacle shivers with the unrestraint of the whole. Every maple leaf is its own Canada, intricate provinces and territories to explore. Every cell is alive. Not billions, not trillions, no numerical concept can capture what our dazzled eyes reveal. We are members in an infinite host of presences. Not all life is human or even visible. Each cell is as alive as is our mind. The complexity, beauty, and importance of autumn derives from the hosts of contributors within its colors. Within cells also, no doubt, there are patchwork hillsides because the world is modeled by components within components and they turn color and change ceaselessly. Autumn colors reveal ineluctable change at every level, at last made visible. Beauty derives from the egoless mortality of parts, tiding out at their own pace. Autumn leaf magic reveals the mosaic microcosm beneath all surfaces. Each one of us is also a cell, a leaf, ablaze and dying in an oceanic infinitude of change upon change. Yet we spend much of our brief passage here unable to speak about the reality we feel. We all yearn for that moment in which we could express to each other the feelings generated by the disruptive, majestic, ego-shattering realities of nature around us. A sense of expansive belonging is available to us. We are born into membership in a panorama of presences. Exemplars of peace like Walt Whitman and Mahatma Gandhi spoke freely about their expanded belonging. Whitman to a poetic cosmos. Gandhi to millions of people, dozens of social, political, and religious reforms. We can be elevated by speaking with each other about what we deeply know. We love the leaves not only for their color, but for the whispering sound of their fall, which we intuitively understand as a language we once shared with all beings. All words are in rhythm. All thoughts are in rhythm. The written word, the spoken word, is like a hand feeling its way into a dark room looking for a switch. Its search is noiseless, unpoliceable. Words of peace enable solitude in elevating company. Reading, at its best, is friendship at its rarest. If you are seeking peace, visit the lands of the forefathers of peace, who have suspended entire invisible kingdoms in the deep Alps of their words. Behind every Whitman is a Krishna and an Isaiah. Behind every Gandhi is a Thoreau and a Socrates. The Buddha himself knew the poetic forms of his time. It is the struggle to understand and communicate that kindles peace. Buddha said, "By seeking truth, I have discovered peace of mind." Our passage into the recess of reverie, analysis, and dialogue and silence is permitted by the serenity and unfinality contained in words of peace. The Shakers were wordsmiths via their song lyrics. Shakers corresponded with Count Leo Tolstoy. Tolstoy's book was one that transformed Gandhi, and Shaker and Gandhian ideas remolded Count Tolstoy into Christian peasant Tolstoy. Whitman and Thoreau met and influenced each other, and Thoreau's civil disobedience became the manifesto for Gandhi's social action. Scott and Helen Nearing read Whitman and Thoreau, as did Rabindranath Tagore. Tagore and Gandhi had a long relationship. John Muir's favorite author was Thoreau. Thoreau carried Leaves of Grass around Concord like a red flag. Seekers of peace read each other, write to each other, influence each other. The quiet life of inner peace isn't a vacuum. The silence of peace is only possible after peace has spoken. Great words go beyond their informative, evocative, transformative properties to seminal ambiguity. They point to a specific cone of darkness. They delineate an essential unknowable. Ultimately, words are important on the path of peace because they point beyond whatever they say. They call on, evoking in the reader or listener an urge to direct personal experience. The role of words in the life of peace is paradoxical. They are essential, and they must be abandoned and transcended. Socrates exemplified this two-sided process, and he set the stage for Thoreau and Gandhi, using words of peace for social betterment, yet pointing to a peace deeper than words. For Socrates, philosophy was a way of life built around the cultivation of emotional calm. He understood philosophy to be the generation of liberating dialectic, conversations whose goal was to free the mind from rigidity. The true test of the rightness of philosophy, according to Socrates, was that it brought so much serenity that the philosopher could face the vicissitudes of life, ostracism, persecution, murder, with equanimity. Philosophy was the art of dying well, which was the litmus test of living well. Words vibrating in face-to-face dialogue were the tools through which the intellect could dilate to a mood, an atmosphere of virtue and limitless unknowing. Socrates passed his own exam, dying under persecution with aplomb and, of course, conversation. When we read the Socratic dialogues recorded by his student Plato, we come away with a sober delirium as if we had inhaled a mind-altering vapor. We feel immersed in dynamic single-mindedness of purpose and austere selectivity, and we ascend into a realm of unrelenting goodwill, deep conviction, and uncertainty. Conviction and uncertainty sound like opposites, but in Socrates' Olympian thought, the conviction is of uncertainty. Even imminent death is a curious topic of unknown import. He inspires his listeners to continue to ascend into the unknown, even at the last moment. Underlying his unflappable ease is his confidence that all of our fears are only superstitions. We have nothing to fear but unexamined thoughts. Words, with their precision at expelling false knowledge, yet their inability to ever define a final truth, are the medium of an unending playful search. Socrates calls us on to live through fate like a boy exploring a mud hole for frogs. The dirt hides leaping wonders. His words are the verbal installation of courage, faith, and peace. The exactness of words enables them to shatter illusion. Their abstraction prevents them from ever pinpointing an absolute finality. Socrates used them to continuously go beyond. Words of peace, to be effective, must resonate with our experience and be free of parochial attitude or reference. They rise out of an aquifer of possibility underlying all cultures and places that can't be divided or owned by one group. The Buddha spoke words of Dhamma, truth that liberates. Dhamma is both content and tone of voice. The Buddha used words both educatively to counsel the importance of moral precepts, for example, and suggestively to inspire his listeners to transcend words and ideas in direct experience of Nibbana. Not only did the Buddha spout a fountain of sermons, he placed great weight on right speech. The way a person converses will be a critical determinant of his fate. Our spiritual progress will be hindered or facilitated by the flavor of our talk. With our words, we can sow discord, suspicion, fear, and hate, or love, peace, harmony, cooperation. The Buddha carefully defined right speech by both content and tone. He speaks the truth, is devoted to truth, reliable, worthy of confidence. He unites those who are divided. Concord gladdens him. He speaks words that are gentle, soothing, loving, such words as go to the heart, and are courteous, friendly, and agreeable. Avoiding vanity, trivia, and the parade of ephemeral distractions, talks of kings and robbers and empires, he instead speaks at the right time, in accordance with the facts, like a treasure uttered at the right moment, moderate and full of sense. Wright's speech outlines an entire continent of life. I have often thought that if a person were to adopt only one aspect of the peaceful life, this would be it, because all morality, relatedness, and self-knowledge are merely provinces within the conglomerate empire of right speech. If I want to live by right speech, I have to know what I think and feel in order to be able to actually parlay the truth that my posture and tone may already be conveying. But to blurt out abrupt, hurtful words, even if they're accurate, isn't acceptable to the Buddha's ideal, and so I not only have to search for my sense of the truth in the moment of interaction, but I have to simultaneously find a channel that is gentle, soothing, courteous. Finally, right speech demands loving words that are honest. This is its apex. To live by right speech, I not only have to be a self-psychologist and a linguist, but I have to learn how to find love in the ordinary gray day facts. Right speech is predicated on disregard for calculation, on cohesion of word and act, and on honest affection, sentence after sentence. Gandhi attempted to live by right speech. Louis Fisher, Gandhi's biographer, visited him at Sevagram Ashram and wrote, this is a quote from Louis Fisher, "Nothing remarkable about him. I felt no awe in Gandhi's presence. A very sweet, gentle, informal, relaxed, happy, wise, highly civilized man. I felt the miracle of personality. He radiated his influence. One has to go back centuries to find men who appealed as strongly as Gandhi did to the conscience. He was a good man in a world where few resist the corroding influence of power, wealth, and vanity. There he sat, 4/5 naked on the earth, in a mud hut, in a tiny Indian village, without electricity, radio, running water, or telephone. He encouraged banter, joked with all. He himself was sometimes surprised by the things he said. His thinking was fluid. He thought out loud. He revealed each step in his thinking. He talked like a friend." Gandhi spoke from the heart to the heart. In ordinary interaction, Gandhi followed the codification of right speech as taught by the Buddha, not because he was a Buddhist, he wasn't, but because he understood that to live a life of inner peace, each of his apparently inconsequential conversations had to flow out of and into peace. An intimate, unguarded, spontaneous conversation with the inspired dead and the circle of the living places us in the ebb and flow of words beyond pretense. There is a particular pool of sound that bathes us in friendship and peace. Words of peace contained in the collective human treasury or murmured anew in obscure corners of the world manifest in sound, the seamlessness of the universe. All boundaries are temporary. Listening to unifying words, speaking them, repeating them, acting in accord with them, we tune up our nervous systems to the voices of time and timelessness. Like geese, we travel in formation behind trailblazers. We migrate by listening to the beckoning call of those who have already pierced the clouds and are flying higher.
Pariyati, a non-profit 501c3 organization, offers a wide variety of books, e-books, videos, and audiobooks about the teachings of the Buddha, the Pali language, and Vipassana meditation. Browse our complete catalog at www.pariyatti.org. That's pariyatti.org.